Now, alcohol is just as much a drug as any other drug. It's just as much a drug as cocaine or pot.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown Estate in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 158 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Whitson. And today, I'm going to try a slightly different concept for this show and the next show, something that I have not done before, and for a promotion that I have not covered in a while, the Universal Wrestling Federation, Bill Watts style. You know, a long time ago, I said that you got to check in with, you know, crazy Uncle Bill Watts, Grandpa Bill Watts, whatever you want to call him, every 15 or 20 episodes, and sometimes you forget to actually visit, but in this case, I'm going to be making back-to-back visits to the old Mid-South territory, as it was once known until 1986, and I've stated in the past how I'm fascinated with promotions when they're in a transition phase. God knows that WCW went through a lot of them, and they're kind of related to why I chose this particular time period. This is going to be the UWF TV from April 25th, 1987. Now, if that sounds very, very late in its run, yes, the UWF was phased out at the end of 1987 when Jim Crockett Promotions bought it earlier in the year, continued the TV, but this April 25th show is the last Bill Watts, the last one where he's in charge. And there's a certain weird vibe going on in this show as I've been watching it that's just, it seems a little off. Now, next week, I'm going to be covering the first Jim Crockett-controlled show of the UWF, where things, in many ways to me, feel like they stopped on a dime and just did like a Tokyo Drift-style U-turn in many ways, and some flaws that JCP, well, they didn't necessarily take full advantage of what the UWF had to offer. Let's just put it that way. But before I get into everything here, why don't I get in my place? You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown at gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. Getting so close to the end. Maybe I will be at the end on Thursday of those show images. As I record this now, I'm around 130, so with this being episode 158, yeah, I'm probably not going to get to the end. I have to post 7 or 8 of them a day. I've learned that it's much easier for me to post them on the laptop because I didn't necessarily save all the pictures on my phone, but I have them all saved on my laptop because that's where I upload into SoundCloud. And also, I should be remiss if I did not mention that you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, and do check out the other great shows on this network, such as Boom Goes the Dynamite, which comes out late Wednesday nights after AEW Dynamite on TNT. I don't know what station that airs on in other countries. Anyway, you're probably American if you're listening to this. I forget what the percentage is of people from other countries listening to this podcast. I know Spotify likes to spit out how my audience is 99% male, so who knows if I can actually buy into the statistics. AEW had pay-per-view this past February 29th. That it's gotten some mixed reviews from what I've heard. I've heard some interesting reactions to that particular show. And I hope you had a wonderful leap day, because I know that I did, going down to Long Island with my friend Merrill for the Bruins Islanders game at the refurbished Nassau Coliseum. So alert everybody, that was a WrestleMania venue at one time. It's now technically called NYCB Live, and it hosted the first part of WrestleMania 2, which, by the way, I watched on the network last week, and I did my thing again where WrestleMania 2 is a good show if you start after the Fabulous Moolah versus Velvet McIntyre match, if you start the second that match ends, the rest of that WrestleMania gets good. Which, of course, means I completely skipped the Nassau Coliseum part of it, because there's really not much to see at all. I mean, sometimes the boxing match with Piper and Mr. T is fun, but the crowd turning on on Mr. T in the middle of it is quite fascinating. Basically turning Roddy Piper babyface in the middle of the match. I mean, the next time you see him, he comes back as a babyface at some point in August. Yeah, he did some house show stuff, but that was like Foxborough Stadium, King of the Ring. And I don't know how canon that would be, even if they did make Harley Race the king out of that. But the Nassau Coliseum, they refurbished it, but they didn't add any bathrooms, so that was one of the big problems of that venue, and they didn't add a concourse space. Other than that, it does look nicer, it's cleaner, the seats are a lot better, you have actual shoulder room, which I can't say for TD Garden. More on TD Garden in just a sec, because that goes into my other story about the upcoming SummerSlam in Boston this August. But trying to tailgate before that Islanders game, it was so cold out, it was about 26 degrees Fahrenheit, the one true temperature measurement system of Greetings from Allentown, that we had to go into the arena at 11 o'clock for a 1 o'clock game. And I say, why are the doors open so early? They were having a jersey retirement for Islander center from the 1980s, Butch Goring, who also was a coach for the Bruins for a very brief period. And all the Islanders legends were on hand for that as number 91 went to the rafters. But honestly, I was just happy to get in from out of the cold. Had really good seats in the fifth row down at the end, towards the end where the Bruins shoot twice. And they happen to score all four of their goals down that end for a 4-0 win. Then after the game, had some dinner with the in-laws who live about 5-10 minutes away. And a good time was had by all. Now, I got to get to the whole SummerSlam thing from TD Garden, because I really don't want to spend too much time on this, but I know that this is what's going to happen, because I've been very paranoid about SummerSlam tickets for the last little while, and I'll tell you why. Is being from this area, I want to take care of people when they come up here. I'm considering myself the unofficial host of SummerSlam and SummerSlam weekend. I want to, you know, be able to tell people, oh yeah, you want to go here, here, and here. Here are the things you want to go when you're in town. I want to be the concierge of sorts for visiting fans from wherever you might be, especially if you listen to this podcast. With all that in mind, though, I go back to what I said a couple weeks ago, where I have to kind of think of Boston as, where would you go if you were a tourist? And I've never really thought of it that way until I had that kind of revelation talking to the people from Louisiana at that brewery a few weeks ago. But people are going to be descending on here, and it's going to be hard to get tickets, because you think about they say the big four, but honestly, they've now scaled down the Survivor Series into something less, where it's the clear number four. So you have WrestleMania, you have the Royal Rumble, and you have SummerSlam. Royal Rumble and WrestleMania have been held in stadiums now for each of the last 2 years, which is notable for Royal Rumble because they got to have it in a dome with it in January. SummerSlam, they have not had it in a stadium since Wembley, I think. I don't think they've had it in an outdoor stadium since then. It'd be pretty cool if they went back to England for something like that. I would totally be down for flying across the pond for that one. But if they're coming here, you got TD Garden, which by the standards of when it was built in the mid-90s, compared to places like Chicago, United Center, Washington, whatever they're calling that place now, the Verizon Center, MCI Center, the Capital One Arena, I forget what it's called. Those stadiums are about 20,000, 21,000 for wrestling. And Toronto, same way for last year's SummerSlam. But Boston is about 18,000 tops for wrestling. So it's going to be a slightly tougher ticket. I don't know if the market is going to be affected by the New Japan show at MSG on that Friday. Who knows if New Japan will actually be running shows at that point. You know, the coronavirus might actually kill us all. By the way, I'm not that worried about that, because it's pretty much something that feels like it's going to fade out fairly quickly, so long as we do not botch the response to it too much, which, please pardon my editorial laugh on that, but hopefully everything will be fine. So I'm just hoping that everybody would be able to get tickets. Now, in that vein, as a Boston Bruins season ticket holder, at one time, I was granted access to basically get tickets. It was like this secret portal where I could buy tickets to events and effectively sit up in the press box level. And I sat there for Springsteen. I sat there for Bob Seger. I sat there for like a lot of concert events and for a couple of Celtics games as well over the years. However, since they renovated the building or started the renovations of the building in 2018, that has pretty much been taken away. The last thing I was able to see was a Raw in March of 2019 alongside Keithy. You could hear us doing play-by-play of a Samoa Joe-Kurt Angle match back at the tail end of episode 108, if you want to check that out in the archives, if you really want to hear that. That's a good nine-minute conversation. But anyway, do not have access to those tickets anymore because they put in premium seating. However, as a season ticket holder, I have a fan relations rep who is a little, he always struck me as a little bit flaky, but that's okay, because what he does is, if Celine Dion is coming to town, he will send out an email saying, suites are available for Celine Dion, please email if you're interested, as if I give a flippity flying you-know-what about getting a suite for Celine Dion or pretty much any other event. Because usually it would just be me and a handful of people, but because I consider myself the concierge here, I think this is actually an event where I might want to get a suite for SummerSlam, NXT, or whatever. So I go to work with my fan relations rep and I say, okay, I need to know how much this is. And I talk to him on the phone. He said he was going to email me information. He never did. I call him, I go and talk to him before the Bruins game last Thursday, and basically sort of confront him like, hey, yeah, I'm the guy who keeps calling about the SummerSlam suites. Can you give me the information here? And I take down the notes, and he said that I explained to him that there's four dates that they are running in a row, and I'm interested in the Saturday date and the Sunday date. And I gave whatever it is, August 22nd and 23rd, I think it is. So Saturday for NXT, the deal is that you can get a luxury suite, and this is without food and drink included. That's a little bit extra, where the first 12 tickets will cost you $100. And then each additional ticket, which would be either up to 18 or 21, so 6 to 9 tickets, would cost $75 a head. And I thought to myself, that's actually not bad. Even if the NXT ticket market might be a little bit softer, you get your own bathroom, you get to hang out with your friends, you all sit together, and that sounds great. But when he tells me that the SummerSlam, like all of the shows from that weekend, are the same price, I think, well, I would be a complete idiot if I didn't get a suite together for SummerSlam. So I reached out to JT Rosero of Place to Be Nation, who would be, you know, be the conduit to the greater group for this sort of thing. And I say, look, here's the price I was quoted, because I told him that this was something I had been working on for a while. And he reaches out, we get a bunch of commitments right away, at least a dozen. So we get to the minimum, and we'd probably have more, especially for SummerSlam on Sunday. So I can't put together a deposit for my fan relations rep for SummerSlam quickly enough. And I call him the next morning. I actually emailed him and said, look, I got to call you this early this afternoon. I was tied up with stuff in the morning at work. So I call him at 12:45, no answer. I'm like, what's going on here? 3 o'clock arrives, and I'm like, all right, this guy, he's not calling me back. And the reason why I'm so antsy is because the pre-sale was that night, and I wanted to nail this down before anybody would go out and buy their own tickets who might have been willing to, you know, pay in for the suite or any of that. So eventually I find another phone number, which is kind of the premium seating sales office of the Garden. And when I reach them, I get the news that, okay, well, the price was a little bit misquoted for NXT. It's $1,200 for the first 12 people, so $100 a head, and then $80 a person after that. So 80 instead of 75, it's negligible. It's no big deal at that point. SummerSlam, No, that is not the same price, I was informed. I didn't say anything. I kind of no-sold it. That is, instead of $1,200 for the first 12 people, it's $3,600 for the first 12 people. So $300 a head and $240 for each additional head. So clearly, that kind of has gone by the wayside, even if I didn't tell them right away that I wasn't interested in that, mainly because I want them to remember to call me for the NXT one, because they will only sell suites when the public on sale is, which didn't really make sense to me, because here's this premium seating and you probably want to sell those, but who knows? I don't know how, you know, they said that SummerSlam would go fast, and that's fine with me, but I still do want to get a suite for NXT, because having the private bathroom and the couch where you can relax and all that sort of stuff is really nice. So that was my story of trying to get a SummerSlam suite. As for the pre-sale, the tickets went so fast, and I stayed up till 11:30 that night. I managed to get a single ticket, which is just kind of being held in reserve, because I may just end up buying more, because I want to make sure that anybody who wants to come to town will be taken care of, and I don't know why I feel like I need to do that. So enough about that. I've gone on. I'm at over the 15-minute mark of just kind of talking about that stuff. So I should get in to the Bill Watts UWF. This is the last Watts show, and I've always expressed an appreciation for the way Bill Watts would present wrestling as a bit as a sport with a sense of realism. But effectively, though, his time was coming up here at the end of the first quarter of 1987. I always talked about how WrestleMania 3 was kind of that oh shit moment in wrestling history, where you have a hell of a lot of people in the Pontiac Silverdome, which, by the way, I talked about the worked attendance number with my friend Merrill on the way back from Long Island, and like, it's not that they worked the attendance number, WWE. You expect wrestling to do that, but because the WWF gave the fake number of 93,173. I'm assuming that it is fake based on all the evidence we have. The fact that they gave a worked number for the Pope later that year, I don't think that gets mentioned enough, where the Pope did a mass there in September of 87, and they made sure to quote a number like 600 above wrestling just to make sure that the Pope wasn't going to, you know, job to wrestle. Like, you say Hogan's not doing any jobs. Pope John Paul ain't doing no jobs, brother. That doesn't work for me. Whether it be Hogan or communism in Eastern Europe and Poland and all that. But anyway, that moment kind of signaled to the wrestling community at large, they're like, yeah, the WWF is the main player. It is the major league. Look at the crowd that you can face off in front of. Think of what your payday is when you're wrestling in front of that many people. And the UWF clearly struggling at this point in time for reasons that I'll get into in a second. This show here was taped on April 5th in Monroe, Louisiana, and the sale of the UWF took place on April 9th. So this is TV that was taped and then aired after the sale. So let's think about the Mid-South Territory here. A lot of talk about how the economic hardships of 1986 and 87, talk the oil glut that happened, that mainly affects a place like Oklahoma and Texas. But let me focus in on Bill Watts' home state of Oklahoma, because usually you don't kind of get this from a wrestling podcast, but some economic data, because I was fascinated into drilling down, because I knew that there was an oil glut in 1986 that caused those areas to go down, but I kind of wondered just numerically how does it factor into a place like Oklahoma or Texas. So Oklahoma, in the year 1982, the per capita income, so the average income of a citizen of the state of Oklahoma, was 100% of the rest of the country. So they're basically at the national average. By 1989, as this recession, sort of state recession, is winding down, they're back at 80% of the per capita income of the rest of the country. bank failures of the savings and loans. That's a completely separate issue that I'm not going to get into the reasons for that. But seven of the top banks failed in Oklahoma. They just went kaput or had to be bailed out or what have you. Corporate bankruptcies. And I'm talking about how the UWF probably would have gone bankrupt as well had they not had Jim Crockett bailing them out for reasons that caused me to scratch my head. Number of corporate bankruptcies rose 12-fold in 1986 over the year 1981. And it's not like the economy was in great shape back in 81, although in Oklahoma it was better relative to the rest of the country, simply because they were so reliant on oil, and that was part of the reason for the downfall. So in 86, you have this oil bust, and you go to other states in the territory, like Louisiana, which lost 9% of its workforce, so that'll cause the unemployment to shoot up. And it took a long time for this to come back, because they were not well diversified, until 1990 for those states to really sort of recover. It was not ripe for an expanding wrestling company set in this area where, yeah, we want to go out and expand to these different areas. But it's odd because the irony is that they, in order to survive, they needed to expand out of these areas. But it was those areas being so poor that mainly was the reason why it went under. Because that is actually where they would tape their TV and still was kind of just their home base. They had to go national, but it was just doomed for failure for reasons, some of them beyond Bill Watts' control. The UWF was totally in trouble and was facing a huge economic crisis. And they were eventually probably going to have to file for bankruptcy if you just waited long enough. But Jim Crockett Promotions comes along and makes a buyout offer. Now, why would they do such a thing? Why would you buy something that you could get for much cheaper, say, maybe not in a bankruptcy court, but in some setting down the road? Well, the legend is that Jim Ross had pitched that the WWF was looking to buy the UWF, and that JCP should just jump in right now, because if WWF buys us, then you guys are completely screwed. So Jim Crockett took the bait, and there it is. Now you have Jim Crockett offering, I forget what the sale price was. I think it was $4 million. Bill Watts saw nowhere even close to that. And Bill Watts has commented on this, of course, and he's a fairly common shoot interview subject through the years. I believe this is the RF video shoot that Bill Watts did years ago. I think it was with Rob Feinstein, which tells you just how long ago this probably was, probably before all the silliness that went on with him at a certain point in time. They negotiated with the WWF because Watts couldn't survive the oil crash, as all the states in the area were dead because of the bad economy. Oh, yeah, I just said that. He tried to blackmail Vince into buying him out by threatening an antitrust lawsuit filed in New Orleans, which was his territory and governed by Napoleonic Code. Not entirely sure what that means, but basically threatening an antitrust thing was maybe a way of getting their attention. But anyway, Vince called his bluff, and eventually they had to take that to Crockett. And with the UWF losing $50,000 a week, it was basically kind of a savior sort of thing going on. So Watts doesn't really get his money because Crockett starts losing money hand over fist after the Thanksgiving War of 1987. When Starcade fails on pay-per-view because of a WWF power play. And it's just kind of a fascinating thing. And I like to cover these times in the various territories. And this is pretty much the end of the UWF as we know it. And I'm not sure I feel fine, because watching the show, there's something about it that just feels a little bit weird. I'm not saying that it's all bad. The UWF television champion Eddie Gilbert is in action. He's defending against Sam Houston, who is yet another guy who is going to be on his way out the door. It's Dr. Death Steve Williams, a staple of Mid-South and the UWF for many years. Chris Adams taking on Angel Muhammad, and a lot more going on here. Terry Taylor is in action. He's very much well connected with Chris Adams. They were a tag team, had just lost the tag team titles when this aired, and a big angle coming up with those two. But this intro has run far longer because I had to go through the damn SummerSlam thing. It really kind of annoyed me that my fan relations rep screwed me on that. And the fact that as a valued 15-year season ticket holder for the Boston Bruins, I kind of feel like I should be assigned a new fan relations rep after this debacle. But we do lead it off with Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer, and you know much I love him, especially, you know, doing this podcast and his Power Slam, where I'm just going to be waiting with bated breath for him to do that. So without any further ado, it's the end of the UWF as we know it, April 25th, 1987. Song entitled Don't Dream It's Over sounds like something about the UWF, but clearly, while there is room for interpretation for that Crowded House song, which reached number two, which is as high as it would go that week in 1987, it had nothing to do with the UWF. Although, funny enough, it was blocked by an Aretha Franklin song that was at number one that week. And Aretha Franklin, of course, did America the Beautiful at WrestleMania 3. So we get a cold open to the program as last week, Buzz Sawyer, who is a babyface at this time, and I couldn't be more delighted by that just from how out of character that seems to be. He's going to be facing the UWF champion, the one-man gang, but they just show the entrances here, so I was kind of left scratching my head like, okay, we're going to show this thing that happened last week, but we're only going to show this little part of it, and it's fine. Just another one of those weird things on this UWF show where they were known for their very good television production, but if you're in a company where, you know, things are nearing the end, whether the company is going out of business or if you're like me in the summer of 97 and you're working at a PetSmart in Burlington with a bunch of wrestling fans and, you know, we don't really care about the merchandise all that much, so we're powerbombing 8-pound bags of Iams dog food like it's Rey Mysterio Jr. and throwing it like a lawn dart into stuff like we're Kevin Nash. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I was doing. It's the same way when your company is closing. So I'm really kind of looking at it through those eyes of like, is there something going on where like they know that something's afoot or there's going to be changes or what's going on? But one of the changes that would not happen is Jim Ross on commentary. And at the start here, he is working solo. He would be joined by others during this show. It is from, I believe I said in the intro, Monroe, Louisiana, at the Civic Center, a building that is still standing. It was built in 1965, and as a matter of fact, hosted a Donald Trump rally in November of 2019. So do with that information what you will. So Jim Ross tosses it to our ring announcer, and I am used to Boyd Pierce or even Jim Ross himself doing the ring announcing in Mid-South UWF, but we have a very familiar face.
Right now, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, let's go down to ring, the ring, and Bruce Pritchard.
For some reason, I was not expecting to see Bruce Pritchard on the show, even though I know he worked for the UWF and wouldn't start with the WWF until, I think, the summer, although he's talked on his podcast about starting at the Worcester, Massachusetts TV tapings, which was in April of 87, right before this point. Actually, it was on April 23rd. So just another one of those guys with the changes afoot in the UWF. Like I said, the sale taking place on the 9th, maybe want to get out of Dodge because maybe there ain't going to be a role for him going forward. I mean, I'm not going to begrudge the guy that. So the opening match is Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer, who, but not against the one-man gang. He's facing off against Mike Boyette, a peculiar fellow who, I don't know if he's known as Hippie Mike Boyette. I saw that come across in my research. But his bit here is, like Jim Ross, any promotion that he's associated with, you're going to get a top 10 list, because, well, we're going to get a top 10 in the UWF a little bit later, But the wins and losses, you want them to matter. It goes into the whole Mid-South thing where you're treating it like a sport. Well, Mike Boyette is kind of like the 2016 Cleveland Browns or the 2008 Detroit Lions.
Now, I did some checking, ladies and gentlemen, on Mike Boyette's record. I mentioned last week that I was going to check into the veteran's record, and since he has been here in the UWF, he's perfect. He's 0-15.
Boyette would never actually win a match in the UWF, which I guess separates him from the Mulkeys in JCP. Kind of funny how that's running concurrently with this, because it was the Mulkeys picking up a win, you know, after so long losing on TV for many, many weeks in a row, and they qualify for the Crockett Cup. And that was the 87 Crockett Cup happening around this time. So I guess you play something like this up on this, but it never really led to anything with Mike Boyette. It's not like he had kind of an interesting look. You know, the old Mulkey / James Ellsworth, pathetic dude sort of thing. But anyway, we got Buzz Sawyer on the other side. You know how much I love him. And he's accompanied by Dark Journey, who always seems to be managing, like, the strangest people at any point in time. Sure, later in 87, she's going to be with Tully Blanchard, which was kind of an odd fit. Admittedly, they say that, you know, kind of going back and shoot interviews, Dark Journey and Ric Flair. All that sort of stuff. But she's managing, like, the missing link in UWF as the babyface manager. And she's with Buzz Sawyer here. And when she leads him to the ring, she's got a dog collar around him. So I guess I don't want to know what they're doing behind closed doors. That's their business as two consenting adults or whatever Buzz Sawyer wants to call himself, which was Bulldog Buzz Sawyer in the WWF, because you can't have two mad dogs in the same place at the same time. But as they're walking to the ring, I'm struck by this one kid, probably like a 12-year-old boy, who runs up to Dark Journey and kisses her on the cheek. It's like, wow, this is very much a different era, because UWF, they just kind of walk through the crowd from one corner, and the baby faces and then the heels would walk in from another corner. Notice they had a little bit more protection on that side. Buzz Sawyer starts out with a slam and then just kind of yells awkwardly, like, sort of like a sick dog or dog with laryngitis. I don't know what his deal was. He's just manhandling Boyette. He actually bites him at one point, and off an Irish whip, he catches Boyette on a leapfrog and hits that power slam, the Buzz Sawyer power slam, which on the Sawyer DiBiase scale, I give a 9.5 out of 10. I think that half a point might be on Boyette. But all I care about here is that I got what I wanted, which was the Buzz Sawyer Power Slam.
Pete Rose just got tough.
Because now I use Tegrin Medicated Shampoo. Head and shoulders, not tough enough. Tegrin's four times tough on all four major causes of flaking and itching. Get four times tough with Tegrin.
I actually laughed when I saw that commercial because it's Pete Rose in the year 1987, the year that he's most associated with betting on the Cincinnati Reds. And I know his name has come up recently with the Astros and sign stealing, which I consider to be a completely different thing than betting on baseball, because it's codified in the rules. I think it's Rule 21, dating back to the Black Sox days, of don't bet on baseball games, especially baseball games involving your own team, or you will be permanently ineligible. And that's pretty much how it should be, and he shouldn't be let in. You say, well, he bet on only bet on his team to win. Well, yeah, while that might be true, although I certainly have some doubts about that, it's that he did not bet on them every single game. So what does that say about, like, he would not bet on the Reds in certain starts made by Bill Gullickson. So what does that say about Pete Rose believing in his chances of his team to win? It's basically a signal to the gambling community at large, where he was probably known amongst the bookies, where, hey, Pete Rose didn't bet on the Reds tonight, so he's probably not going to use his best relief pitchers. And one thing Pete Rose, as a manager, is he would definitely lean on his better relief pitchers, bringing them in 85 to 90 times a season. Hell, on this day in 1987, well, he didn't go to Rob Murphy in that game, who's one of the aforementioned relievers, but he did go to Frank Williams to close out a 10-inning win against the Houston Astros. Yes, the closer was named Frank Williams for the Cincinnati Reds. No, not related to the Frank Williams from Columbus, Ohio, who was on the Piper's Pit that I covered several episodes ago. So we have Gary Young here. And Gary Young is definitely one of those names that I hear, but I never really think of him in a wrestling context because he's not a guy that registered with me in any real way. And opposite him is, well, I guess he stole $39,000 from Chavo Guerrero Sr., or Chavo Classic, as he's known in more modern times. By the way, $39,000 seems to be an oddly specific amount. Maybe there was something there, where a battle royal. Maybe it was an after-tax thing. Maybe it was a 401k withdrawal. I have no idea. So they actually show a Chavo Sr. versus Mike Boyette match, because we can't get enough Mike Boyette on this program, as Gary Young walks to the ring, and I'm thinking, are we going to get a distraction finish? And I remembered, oh yeah, Mike Boyette is 0-15, now 0-16, as Jim Ross said earlier. And he just kind of Chavo catches Boyette, hits him with a beautiful belly-to-belly overhead suplex and picks up the win that way, and then proceeds to run out of the ring and chase Gary Young around and grabs an envelope that Gary Young had in his hand, but it turns out to be empty. And I'm wondering, what the hell is the point of this? I mean, are we just trying to remind ourselves of what happened the previous week? I know that the WWF, in the way they would produce shows, this is something that would be more in an update segment. It does connect into the next bout, which is Gary Young taking on Terry Taylor, who I will admit is very popular, it seems, even in the UWF in 1987. But it's the only place that he ever seemed to be really over with me, anyway. And it tends to be more of his earlier stuff, mainly when it was Mid-South Wrestling. The Country Whippin' match against the Freebirds, where he's teaming with Ted DiBiase. That's one that I have saved down on YouTube that I think I've returned to watch a couple of times. Now, he was the tag team champion, one half of the tag team champions, with Chris Adams in February and March before a loss to Rick Steiner and Sting, which we're going to hear more about that later on and gain a little bit more insight into what's going on with Terry Taylor and Chris Adams, because something's afoot, but I'll save that for when that comes up. Headlock takeover, head scissors kick up. They do that mat spot 2 times in a row, as JR is heavily promoting the house shows on commentary. Again, this is some WWF would do the voiceover with Howard Finkel, but JR was pretty good at working in those things, especially in WCW, you know, telling you what's coming up at the Omni, even if it made them seem a little bit more localized. You'd think that Atlanta was the center of the universe if you watched WCW Saturday Night during a specific period of time. Young misses an elbow, and this seems to be one of those matches where stuff happens for about 30 seconds, and then they reset and just kind of lock up again. But Young hits a clothesline and a slam, but he misses on a knee drop, so Taylor just decides, oh, screw it, I'm going to go for the figure four. But before he can get that locked in, here comes Sting and Rick Steiner again, and they run in, and that basically causes the DQ. They can't quite get to Taylor, who bails out of the ring before they can get to him, which just struck me as really odd. Not quite as strange as heel Sting, where he looks like the surfer Sting that we would come to know and love for the next 7 years in JCP and later WCW. It just feels weird seeing him like that, but it's also fascinating. Ultimate Warrior, he's long gone out the door, so that Blade Runner stuff is a thing of the past. He probably wasn't the best fit for the Bill Watts promotion anyway. Sting, a little bit different, a little bit more willing to go with the flow and be somebody who is going to learn. And when I was reviewing this show, and I was watching it, and I decided to actually look up the results of the show in Monroe, Louisiana. And I saw, okay, well, Terry Taylor defeated Gary Young by disqualification. And I thought to myself, I can't believe I went and I spoiled the result of a Terry Taylor-Gary Young match. And I think what's even worse than that is the fact that I care about that.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a lot of you know, gentleman Chris Adams has been through an ordeal in the last 7 to 8 months that he hopes a lot of you don't ever have to go through. And Chris is here to basically fill us in on a little bit what you went through and hopefully deliver a message so the folks out there won't have to.
Many of you listening to this podcast might be a little bit more schooled in the sort of minutiae of professional wrestling through the years. Not that this is necessarily that in what happened to Chris Adams, but as they're saying, he had this ordeal over the last 8 or 9 months. So you think of that term, it's like, okay, did the guy go through a bad divorce? Did he get like a bad health diagnosis? Did he have to have like a lump removed or, you know, something to that effect? That, like, that's what they kind of are leaning towards. Well, before Adams goes into it and kind of describes things out, let me read the UPI story from the time period. This would be September 17th, 1986, so it would be about 8 months before this. Dateline, Fort Worth, Texas. Headline, wrestler convicted of mile-high assault. A professional wrestler who headbutted, I love how headbutted is in quotes, as if we need, I mean, a headbutt is a headbutt. We kind of know what that is. Who headbutted an airline pilot during a flight from the Caribbean has been convicted of misdemeanor assault and faces up to 6 months in jail. Chris Adams of Dallas was convicted Tuesday for attacking a co-pilot on an American Airlines flight. In addition to a jail term, he faces fines of $500. The judge will sentence Adams next month, so obviously he went away for a while. The jury reflected a felony charge of interfering with a flight crew member, which could have meant 20 years imprisonment and a fine of up to $250,000. If Adams, a native of Great Britain, had been convicted on the felony, he also would have been deported. During the trial, testimony showed Adams headbutted American co-pilot John Bentley 3 times during a June 30th flight after Bentley tried to subdue the wrestler. Adams became unruly because flight attendants refused to serve him more alcohol. Talk about self-fulfilling prophecy there, I guess. Bentley was not seriously hurt. He suffered a cut on his nose before other wrestlers on the flight to Dallas helped subdue Adams. There was no excuse for him to do what he did, Mahan told jurors, that's the judge, after the verdict was announced. He hurt not only himself, but professional sports. It hurts professional wrestling. After his conviction, Adams said the trial was more nerve-wracking than wrestling before 50,000 fans. Like, all right, Chris, you did not fill up Texas Stadium or anything world-class, you know, not in the greatest shape. Although I know that they did a pretty good number back in 84, and you were working in the territory at that point. So that is his ordeal. He headbutted a pilot. Which I know we've all had our frustrations with airlines over the years, but I would recommend not headbutting the pilot. It's probably not going to help you if the flight is delayed, because then they got to bring in another member of the flight crew. They have to make sure he's got proper rest. So, okay. Chris Adams is here. He's not a felon. He's convicted on the misdemeanor, because if he was a felon, as it said, he would have been deported, which I guess separates this from the Ken Patera thing in the WWF, which is going on at the exact same time. And that was a miserable failure. So seeing this is kind of interesting. They seem to be doing a better job of it because in the TV that I've seen, Chris Adams is being cheered by the fans to a greater extent than Patera, although I think Kenny was hurt by the fact that he tore his bicep pretty soon into his run and kind of stunted any momentum he might have. I'm wondering, though, alcohol service on an airplane versus throwing a rock in a McDonald's, although really the Patera thing was roughing up the cops with Saito afterwards. I don't know. Just something to ponder, that which thing. I guess for each of us, which one are you more likely to get into trouble for? Well, for me, since I haven't eaten at McDonald's in like 24 years, it would clearly be the not getting served on an airplane. Although I once got 3 beers on a Virgin America flight because they screwed up and opened 2 anchor steams and they like, well, that guy just keeps ordering them, so just bring him a third. So they were very nice to me there. So Chris Adams, I guess this is going to be a PSA on the dangers of alcohol.
I was very honored when the UWF mentioned that I could do a public announcement. And I want to be doing this all over the country, you know, not just in wrestling. And the reason being is I'd like to convey my mistakes over to you people so that you won't be making the same mistake that I made. Take my mistake as a lesson. Now, alcohol is just as much a drug as any other drug. It's just as much a drug as cocaine or pot. And I know that everybody enjoys a drink. Everybody likes that last drink. But you see, that's where the problem begins.
The sad irony of this is that Chris Adams would continue to get himself into trouble with alcohol. You know, some people have different reactions to it, and he was kind of what is known as an angry drunk, and he would really get himself into trouble whenever he would drink. He basically should have just stayed away from it entirely, but said, you know, everybody likes a drink. Okay, fair enough. And British guys, they always have great credibility. Like, they can tell you anything. It could be the dumbest British guy in the world, and he's gonna sound smart because of the accent. Like, he doesn't talk like me. It's like the thing, like, oh, a garbage man from Great Britain, their Duke the Dumpster Drossy, I guess, is smarter than, like, a Lanny Poffo, the genius, from Alabama, or something like that. So, like, for whatever reason, there's a certain bias towards the British accent over the Southern accent. I guess, I don't know, maybe that's why Parv and Chad Campbell work so well on Where the Big Boys Play. Just that kind of contrast between the two guys. Now, he's trying to deliver this PSA. Now, the WWF did these, you know, with Steamboat telling us not to use weed because he's always high. You know, Tito Santana telling us not to swim alone. Bobby Heenan telling us not to drink and drive. I've always questioned whether you should have the top heel manager delivering such a message. But as Chris Adams is delivering this, he's going to get attacked.
That's where...
What the hell?
What?
Hey, get it! Hey, somebody get... Oh, yeah.
I know that doesn't lend itself too well to an audio podcast, but Sting, Rick Steiner, Eddie Gilbert, they all come in and rough up Chris Adams as Bruce Pritchard is yelling for help. So why did I let that thing run for 30 seconds or whatever it was? The fact that Bruce Pritchard yelled cut at the end to the camera, it sounds like a mistake. I think he was just telling him to cut it off, but the way he yelled cut was funny to me. For whatever reason, like, I started laughing, which, that's fine to laugh at a situation like that, because it's just kind of a weird thing. It's not like the thing on this past Monday's Raw, and I know I usually don't talk about modern product, but you have the segment with Randy Orton and Beth Phoenix, where you know it's inevitable that Randy Orton is going to rough up Beth Phoenix, and whatever feelings you might have, man-on-woman violence like that... Okay, they took it very seriously, like Randy Orton is a psychopath, like in the aftermath of it. But when he did the RKO, what does that stupid motherfucker Kevin Dunn directing Raw like a idiot do? He's such a Oh, we're going to cut to four neckbeard professional masturbators in the Brooklyn crowd who are like smiling, clapping, and like at man-on-woman violence. Like, you can't expect us to take this seriously if you're going to cut to that when something like what we just witnessed happens. It's so stupid. WWE, their production is so good at times in terms of like the packages, recapping angles, but they are such idiots when it comes to stuff like that. Anyway, other than that, I think they're decent guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm standing here with one of the premier tag teams in the entire wrestling community today. It is Terry Taylor, gentlemen, Chris Adams, and gentlemen, it is a pleasure having you here.
I don't think anybody gives a rat's ass in UWF production at this point either, because you have a beatdown of Chris Adams, you go to a commercial break, and then you come right back with a Chris Adams, Terry Taylor promo. Now, I know it's in a different place, and you're giving the impression that that PSA was pre-recorded somewhere else, but I just feel like the placement is a little odd. I just saw this guy get the crap kicked out of him by three dudes, and now all of a sudden he's standing next to Terry Taylor on here. Unless maybe you're trying to send the message that, why didn't Terry Taylor help him previously? Well, who knows? If they were recording it somewhere else, maybe Taylor wasn't there at the time. I just think it's a little strange. But like I said, this might be a case of, well, the whole thing's going under. Who cares?
You know something, you people? I told you some time ago that I would try and convey messages to you from the mistakes I've learned in life. And one of the major mistakes that I've learned is to never, never give in. I mean, it doesn't matter how hard things seem at the time. Tough times don't last, but tough people do.
I wasn't entirely sure where Adams was going with that. I didn't know if he was going to continue with the drinking PSA that he was going on earlier. If it was going to be something like, now if you, when you've been drinking, don't trust a fart, okay?
So you see, I thought, well, I have faith in my mate and my tag team partner, Terry Taylor. And I knew that you would come through in time. And Terry, I have to officially thank you for saving me.
You don't have to officially thank me for anything. I have to thank a guy like this who went out there and wrestled two guys at once. He jumped at the chance. Now, if it would have been me, I might have had to think about it a little bit. Just kidding. I would have been there. Don't worry. There's a lot of things going on in the Universal Wrestling Federation, Power Pro Wrestling. Chris and I feel like we're the tag team of the 80s. We're moving forward. Sometimes you have a few setbacks, but it's like he said, the hard times don't last, and the hard time, the hard people do.
I absolutely hate Terry Taylor's voice, and I don't know if I've gone into this on the podcast before, and I know he gets a lot of crap for the whole Red Rooster thing, which might not entirely be all of his fault, but for God's sakes, the way his voice is, I don't know if he's doing it on purpose or if he can't help it, but the come on, Taylor, for God's sakes. It's just obnoxious to listen to your voice, and I'm saying this talking with a Boston accent, okay? I mean, I think people could tolerate this a little bit more than Terry Taylor. So he's acting very self-serving. Taylor was late to a title defense. That was what Chris Adams was referring to. And they ended up losing the tag titles. There's an 8-minute video about this entire turn on YouTube, which I'm kind of afraid to go into because we're going to see them again on next week's show. But the fact is, they lost the tag team titles in part because when Taylor was getting pinned, or Adams was getting pinned, Taylor kicked his partner's foot off the ropes. Now, you could argue maybe it was an accident, and he was over on that side of the ring battling guy on the other side. I can't remember if it was Sting or Rick Steiner. But that whole thing is at odds with another part of this storyline that they're pushing, is that Terry Taylor is only obsessed with keeping the belts. So he would, you know, force some DQs and, you know, so that they could keep the titles going forward. Not the most babyface maneuver. So you're thinking, okay, well, he's just obsessed with keeping the belts. He's not just concerned with his own self-dealing or whatever. So it's kind of at odds with each other. And I'm not sure if this is complex storytelling or if maybe I'm reading too much into this, which is entirely possible, I think, because things here at this point in UWF history might be a bit more simple than it seems.
Thanks for staying with us, everyone. In just a few moments, you're going to see Steve Dr. Death Williams.
Seek immediate medical help for an erection lasting more than 4 hours.
Lucky for us that Jim Ross is merely being fluffed at this point. I believe that's the proper term in anticipation of the Dr. Death match that he'll be calling in a little bit. And he is alongside Chavo Classic, Chavo Guerrero Sr., who's got the issue with Kerry Young over the $39,000, which I will admit in 1986 or 87, as it were, it's, you know, a lot more money than it is today. I'm not going to bust out the inflation calculator, but I'd say that that's about $70,000 at this point in time.
They say that money is the root of all evil, and when you get down to a business, any professional sport, you can see it, you know, you go from nothing to making a lot of money, and there's a lot of pressure. You just can't make money and then forget about it. Once you make a certain amount of money, then your lifestyle goes up, your spending goes up, and you have to keep making that money. And to keep making that money, you have to stay on top. And to stay on top, there's a lot of pressure. So evidently, money changes people.
Money changes people on a couple of different levels. Number one, it's the pursuit of said cash. And then number two is once they have that cash, then they now start acting a little bit differently. Chavo Classic is kind of a blind spot for me in WWF history, although in watching these Ruthless Aggression documentaries, the one on Brock Lesnar is out this week and is very good. A lot of interesting stuff there. I feel like I could do a new podcast, which would basically just be Pete reacts to seeing stuff from 2003 to 2010 for the very first time, because I just don't know any of it. I've never done a podcast on anything between the years 2003 and 2011, unless I'm completely forgetting something. I know I did an 01 Metal or Jacked or whatever the hell it was, and then I did that 2012 Saturday Morning Slam, which I'll probably never do again because I don't think anybody listened to that show. And I checked the inflation calculator. It would be $88,000, would be equal to $39,000 from 1987. So clearly a little bit more to play with than that. Now, if you just dropped $88,000 in my lap right now, trying to think what I would do with it. Number one, I would book a vacation to one of those South Pacific islands where you got the little bungalow over the water. I've always wanted to go to one of those. And then secondly, I would buy new appliances for the house, starting with a washer and dryer that would come with a thing that cleans the dryer hose so that I never have to friggin' do that job again, and a new dishwasher as well, because I think that one is now 25 years old. So Chavo is just wrapping up in the UWF, just, you know, as the company is wrapping up as well. And he's in a long line of guys who are just going to be disappearing from this area because of all the changes taking place.
At number 10, Terry Taylor. Number 9, Gentleman Chris Adams. Number 8, Iceman Parsons. Number 7, Sam Houston. Number 6, Chavo Guerrero. Number 5, Michael P.S. Hayes. Number 4, Savannah Jack. The number 3 contender is Ted DiBiase, a tie for the number 2 position. Terry Bam Bam Gordy and Steve Dr. Death Williams. The number 1 contender is the television champion, Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert. And the number 1 man in the Universal Wrestling Federation, the 500-pound one-man gang.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Oh, the times, they are a-changing.
I might be getting ahead of myself here for next week's show, but the one-man gang's hold on the UWF title is a bit tenuous. And I'm not talking about the fact that somehow they managed to put 11 guys in the top 10 contenders for the title. It's like Dick Vitale picking his diaper dandies team in college basketball. It's like, how the hell do you have 18 All-Americans for 5 spots? I mean, give me a freaking break here. And you'll notice that number one contender, Eddie Gilbert, yes, he's a television champion. That's the way Jim Ross always does his top 10, his precious little top 10 that he loves so much. But number two is Terry Gordy and Dr. Death. They're tied. Okay, that's fine. You always link those guys together anyway. But it goes to number three. No, that's not how it works. If two guys are tied at second, you go to fourth place because that means that there are three people ahead of them. Ted DiBiase being number three, I have this recollection, and maybe it's from something that I listened to, maybe it was even the death of the Universal Wrestling Federation series, Exile on Bad Street, that was done a long time ago, 5 years ago. Zellner, Bix, and Dylan Hales, I think, was the third guy on that, covered that. There was an angle where DiBiase was pissed about the rankings, and it was going to go down where he was going to turn heel, but he ended up leaving, so it ended up leading to nothing. So I guess it's one of those Jim Ross things where, yeah, you use the rankings to set up an angle for whatever reason. So our Dr. Death match is against the Super Ninja. And you may remember him from such Greetings from Allentown episodes as the AWA in 1987, where this guy showed up in a promo and he was literally wearing a f***ing swastika on his hand. I know it's been a lot of F-bombs and I try to control it because I have to go back and then bleep it out. And it's just one of those things that I feel like I have to do. But, I mean, I feel like it's appropriate after that whole swastika thing. Of course, this predates that by, I believe, a month, because that was a May 87 AWA show. I think he might have been just coming in at that point. Super Ninja over in Japan. He actually jumped to All Japan in 1984. I believe he was part of some sort of exodus from New Japan to All Japan. And Dr. Death, of course, synonymous with All Japan Pro Wrestling. I mean, it goes into the thing about dumping guys on their heads. Who else but Dr. Death? He hits a running clothesline to start out. But even though you might associate Dr. Death Steve Williams with the nation of Japan and the wrestling scene there as one of the great gaijins in the history of Japanese wrestling, Jim Ross says that, well, maybe he doesn't have the appreciation for them that they might have for him.
Dr. Death with that clothesline. He just got back from Japan, Chavo. He's not real high on our Oriental neighbors, I can tell you that.
No, he's not.
Well, I'm just hoping that didn't get back to Giant Baba in some form or fashion. The word Oriental is completely inappropriate unless you're going rug shopping or if you're looking for good Chinese food in Woburn Center in the northern suburbs of Boston. Oriental Restaurant is there to meet all your needs. Best lo mein in the region, even better than the Kowloon up in Saugus, which I like to go to every 2 to 3 months because it's just a wonderful place. I've talked about that many times. It's the place where the wrestlers go after shows at TD Garden. They go up Route 1 to the Kowloon in Saugus. But yeah, might not want to get a leak word of that. Might hurt his Japan deal in the long run, considering that, you know, he probably likes working over there later on better than he would in the States. A headbutt. Chavo, as you heard there, is on color. And they mentioned the UWF training camp, but we're actually going to see a commercial for that a little bit later, so I'll just save my thoughts. And Chavo's son is working on that show, Glow, which reminded me, oh shit, I have to go back and watch the last 6 episodes of Glow. I, like, stopped watching it, and then I resumed my Mad Men watch during my unemployment over the summer. Oklahoma Stampede finishes. This does not last very long. And I was kind of surprised that Dr. Death still has Born in the USA as his theme music. And it reminded me of something that came up over the weekend on my journey down to Long Island with my friend Merrill, because he likes to put on E Street Radio on the way. It's the Bruce Springsteen channel on Sirius XM. And usually I think he listens to Pearl Jam Radio, and I like Pearl Jam plenty, but Bruce kind of, you know, it's a thing that unites us, because I'm as familiar with Bruce's music as he is, and they play a lot of live stuff. Anyway, Born in the USA album, biggest hit that Bruce Springsteen ever had. And the Boss, he's known for his rather liberal politics. And I thought about that album a great deal, because, you know, you get a lot of time. It's about 4 hours going down there, although we did get there a little early and had to stop at a diner for breakfast. Oh, boo-hoo, I had to eat an omelet at a Long Island diner. I'm really broken up about that. But Born in the USA, big album that came out in 1984, and I want to make this point, because I talked about how the sales of it lifted the country economically, you know, on the heels of Thriller and all that. But that album has a lot of gay overtones on it. And I think it's like the greatest secret gay rights album that was ever made. First of all, look at the album cover. It's a picture of Bruce's ass with, it looks to be either a hat or a red kerchief in his back pocket. Now, I've seen the movie Cruisin' with Al Pacino, and I know that there's a whole signal system in where if you have a red handkerchief in your back right pocket, that means that you're willing to be a submissive bottom in any sort of sexual encounter. And then the album also has I'm on Fire, about a guy, you know, burning up. He wants to act on something but can't. Could be about a closeted gay man. Born in the USA itself. It could be that Vietnam is just an allegory for being gay. Other songs include I'm Going Down, Downbound Train. I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, do you really want me to go through this and ruin the entire album for you? Because I kind of did that for my friend Merrill. No Surrender. Oh, he's not into S&M or anything like that. Dancing in the Dark. It's a little dark in closets. That's all I'm saying with that. Cover me. Cover you with what? What exactly are you talking about? But actually, I love that album, and it is one of the ones that I have on my wall, so I shouldn't rank on it too badly. After all, Bruce doing a song about a Vietnam vet is probably about a Vietnam vet, considering he's done, you know, Vietnam memorial shows in 81 and on other tours. I'm sorry, I don't want to turn this into like the Springsteen nerd podcast.
I had a little sweet spot for the rain. For the rain and skies of gray. Hello, sunshine, won't you stay?
A Again, not to keep up the Bruce theme, but that song is Hello Sunshine from Western Stars, an album that he released in June of 2019, along with an accompanying movie that I have not seen to this point. But Sunshine is actually here in the UWF in 1987. See, I had thought that when I saw that Bruce had a song called Hello Sunshine, I thought that he had been watching world-class footage from 83 and 84. But apparently he's also been watching a little bit of UWF, because Sunshine is one of several female valets in the company. Four of them at this point. You got two heels, Sunshine and Missy Hyatt. And Missy's presence there is kind of interesting for reasons that I'll get into in a second. On the other side, you have Nicola, who used to be known as Baby Doll in Jim Crockett Promotions and would be again in about a year, and also Dark Journey, who was with Buzz Sawyer at the top of the show. So Sunshine is in the ring talking, and this is actually going back to last week's show, so this is kind of a review segment. And Sunshine is talking, and Missy Hyatt makes her way out to the ring, and they just kind of dish. So it's just kind of standard fare, Mean Girls style BS from the two of them towards the two babyface managers that I talked about. But the thing with Missy that's so interesting is that she's doing WWF Missy's Manor segments, which are somewhat infamous for the fact that they taped those, I think it was on two different sets of Superstars tapings. This was going to be the thing that replaced Piper's Pit as the talk show segment on Superstars. And apparently, they were so bad that they just never aired them. Now, I've seen a couple of them on YouTube, and I had a certain curiosity to them. Like, well, they couldn't possibly be that bad. And yes, they were. It was basically probably a thing of, well, we could air this, but this is not going to last very long, and we don't want to have a talk show segment that just lasts 6 weeks and put her on TV. So they weren't bringing in Eddie Gilbert anyway, which I'll get into because we got Eddie coming up a little bit later defending the TV title. But it's so weird because she had already taped some of them before this one would have been filmed, I think, unless this was at a prior TV taping. I really don't want to tie myself up in knots. But so the former Baby Doll, Nicola, she makes her way out. And I got to say, this whole thing for valet on valet feuds, the gold standard is, you could say, I guess, Sherry and Elizabeth in WWF, but that was kind of a non-wrestler and somebody who was a women's champion. The gold standard is World Class 83 into 84, Sunshine and Precious. This, on the other hand, even though you got one of the people from that one, it feels very sort of heatless to me.
Well, wait a minute. Bruce Pritchard has left the ring, and that was a good move. Oh, good gosh! Sunshine just took Missy's Gucci bag, whatever's in there, and she has KO'd Nicola. Missy is leaving the premises. She didn't want any physical confrontation. But look at this, and she's rubbing Nicola's face on that the canvas. I mean, that will take hide, hair, and feathers, as it were. The skin, you can almost, that's one of the most severe burns that you can have on your anatomy. That canvas, here comes Dark Journey.
Yeah, just to not hear the crowd reaction that I'm looking for. So to solve that, what I would have booked is they would have cut her hair, because there's nothing that can't be solved by booking a hair angle, at least in my mind. And we got another story from previous weeks that JR wants to get into, a disgusting thing, as he refers to it, where Savannah Jack, who we met in the UWF January of 87 show that I covered almost a year ago now, where he was handcuffed and attacked on the ropes after a bout with Gary Young, who seems to be the Forrest Gump of this promotion, where he's not really doing anything, but he turns up in everything that's going on. As Iceman Parsons runs in, he gets super kicked by Jack. But once again, Eddie Gilbert's crew, who seem to specialize in run-ins when you don't expect it, they end up doing the cuffing, but the whipping is done by somebody else.
They're triple teaming Savannah Jack, and they've got some handcuffs. They've got a pair of handcuffs, Steiner and Sting holding Savannah Jack. This is a a hideous situation. Steiner hammering away on Savannah Jack, and they have handcuffed Savannah Jack to the top rope. And the Iceman has got that belt. He's lashing. Iceman Parsons. They're stretching Savannah Jack out. Listen to those lashes.
Yeah, I can hear the lashes, JR. The reason being that Savannah Jack, they really don't care about him all that much, so they're not going to scream like little girls like they're in the WMC studio in Memphis and something's happening to Lawler or one of the heroes there. But the good thing, though, with this whipping angle is you have a black man handcuffed to the ropes, and you don't want one of the white guys whipping him because the optics on that are particularly bad. You know, in the state of Oklahoma, sometimes the racial history there, just read up about Black Wall Street in Tulsa in 1921 if you want to get a little bit more information on that. It's been in the news that they're teaching that now in the Oklahoma public schools, for which I wonder why they weren't teaching it in the first place, where basically lynched black people in Tulsa and destroyed their businesses that they had built up. But anyway, they had Iceman do the whipping because black-on-black crime is okay, apparently. But at least the optics of it are not as bad as it could be. So we get a little bit now on Devastation Incorporated, General Skindor Akbar's group, and the Freebirds are in a row at this point. And you got Angel Muhammad and Bill Irwin as kind of the representatives of that, and they're in a match with Steve Cox and Dr. Death. And there's a dude with a Confederate flag down front, which I found rather amusing, but again, very different time. You had the Dukes of Hazzard on the air, which the freaking Confederate flag was the roof of the freaking car.
And coming to the ring, ladies and gentlemen, Terry Bam Bam Gordy and the one-man gang, and it is breaking down right here in Monroe.
Whenever Jim Ross says it's breaking down, you know it's a pretty crazy brawl, at least in that time period. He would change his verbiage up over the years. But they use a whip in this one, too, but not to actually whip a guy, but to do a shot to the throat. So I think it's a little weird that you would kind of use the same foreign object back-to-back. Although I guess if it's just something they happen to have, I guess that works out. But something seems very off about this show that, again, in retrospect, with it being the last Bill Watts show, that probably does explain a lot about what I'm seeing here.
Gantner, there he goes. The pitch, a swing and a fly ball, right field and deep. Get up and get out of here. Gone for Swain, and they've done it again. 12 in a row on a two-run blast by Swain to win it. Oh, my goodness. Holy cow, do you believe it?
At the beginning of the 1987 baseball season, one of the big stories was the Milwaukee Brewers winning their first 13 games of the season, something that hadn't been done before. That is from Easter Sunday, the 20th of April. They win their 12th straight game in Texas. Very frustrated. Mitch Williams gave up a home run in the ninth inning. Clearly, that would be the worst blown save that Mitch Williams would ever have. Sorry, Philadelphia listeners. I really apologize for that. But the 1987 Milwaukee Brewers are just a fascinating team because they start out 13-0, and you figure, okay, well, they're going to be a good team. And yes, they did finish 91-71. That was only good for third in the American League East, not good enough to make the playoffs, obviously. But 13-0, and then later on, they had a 12-game losing streak where they fell to a record of 20-15. They were incredibly up and down during the season with a lot of long winning streaks and a lot of long losing streaks. Then you get to late in the season, and the great Paul Molitor, who would go on to become a baseball Hall of Famer, had a 39-game hitting streak fairly late in the year. One of the, I think it's in the top 15 in baseball history. So a lot of fun things happening for the Milwaukee Brewers that year. Of course, all their games were in the outdoor County Stadium, which I don't know if you know, in the movie Major League, the Indians in the original movie play, the movie is set in County Stadium. They did not actually film it in Cleveland. I don't know. If I ever did a podcast about interesting sports teams, 1987 Milwaukee Brewers would definitely be on the list, and I would watch a 30 for 30 on them. Even if it didn't lead anywhere, it's all kind of interesting to me. So our final bout, I guess our feature bout here on UWF television is Eddie Gilbert taking on Sam Houston. And I guess, well, technically there's one more bout going on here, but I'll get to that when I get to it. And Gilbert, of course, is the television champion. But first, we have Booker extraordinaire of, well, world class in 1983, Ken Mantell. He's apparently also booking UWF around this time, I think. The timeline, I'm a little hazy on who was in charge. But I'm assuming that he was because of, he had been booking pretty much everywhere he had been. Ken Mantell alongside Jim Ross for this one. And it just kind of going through the goings-on in the UWF. I mean, if you want to get something over, it's good to have the booker out there because he knows what he wants to push.
It seems like that everyone has gone crazy. You know about the situation with Gary Young and Chavo Guerrero. You know the situation with Iceman. He's gone off the deep end. The situation with the Freebirds and Devastation is real dangerous, Jim. You take, this is two of the meanest, most devious organizations in pro wrestling today, and they're at each other's throats. The Freebirds have come in repeatedly, demanded a match, a Bad Street match, any kind of a match. They literally put their $1 million contract on the table and said, get us that match or else.
This is a pretty good segment to review everything that's going on. Personally, I would put it a little bit earlier in the show rather than more than two-thirds the way through it. But then again, who cares? The whole thing is changing next week anyway. So as for Eddie Gilbert, who's in the next match, what's going on with him? Apparently, he'd been feigning some injuries in order to get out of title defenses. Certainly weaselly, squirrely, but that's kind of the way Eddie Gilbert operated in that character.
But let me say this. Eddie Gilbert is a weasel, and he weaseled out. I thought I had him here just a few weeks ago when we said he'd have to meet Sting. He weaseled out of that. We put him in against a one-man gang. I thought then for sure he'd get what was coming to him. He weaseled out of that. He and that Iceman are getting in a position where they're going to get what's coming to them sooner or later.
So Ken Mantell seems to be a babyface authority figure. Hey, remember those when you didn't have to have the heel authority figure making the matches and screwing over the babyface? Like, oh yeah, you can flip it on its face and have the heel have to work against it and, you know, try to overcome the odds by weaseling out of everything and thereby generating heat. So some good stuff here, and Mantell is actually going to stay on commentary. Now, when I look at these two guys in this match, Eddie Gilbert and Sam Houston, and you just think of what I know about each of them, and you're like, all right, which one would you want in your wrestling promotion, all things being equal? And Eddie Gilbert considered too small for the WWF, and yet they take Sam Houston, and they start him in the month of May, so not long after this. And I'm thinking, okay, so Eddie Gilbert is bigger than Sam Houston, but you're going to bring Sam Houston in even though, like, name your favorite Sam Houston promo of all time, please. I would love to know, because I can't think of a single solitary thing that he ever said in any promotion. Whereas Eddie Gilbert, we know that he could talk, and talk very well. He could lead a faction, and yet I guess the WWF had no use for a guy who was going to lead a faction like that because they had their manager. So yes, Sam Houston wraps up on April 28th because Dusty Rhodes did not care for him because he married Baby Doll, and that meant, well, it meant a lot of things. I'm not going to cast any aspersions on Dusty Rhodes, but let's just say he couldn't work with Sam Houston after Sam Houston married Baby Doll, which, you know, is what it is, although Baby Doll would go and have the angle with Dusty with the pictures where we never found out what that was, although I did speculate on what those pictures were back in episode 86 Crockett, which I do remember because I posted those screen images, and I remember talking about that on that show. Now, they were kind of working around the horn, Eddie Gilbert and Sam Houston. And there's an interesting match from the Tingley Coliseum, which I talked about on the Place to Be podcast, because it is on the New Mexico State Fairgrounds. And that show took place on April 26th. And I believe Jim Ross plugs the house show on this show. But Eddie Gilbert defeated Sam Houston in 46 minutes, 17 seconds. And I'm scratching my head because I kind of want to see that match just to see how Eddie Gilbert and Sim Houston laid out a match that lasted 46 minutes. Was this a deal where other guys were late getting to the venue, or, you know, what exactly was going on? But yes, as I said, Sam Houston, he pops into WWF in May. And I wonder, how do you end up choosing him over Eddie Gilbert? Because you're bringing in Missy Hyatt at the same time, and you don't want to bring in Eddie Gilbert, but you want to bring in Sam Houston. I don't get it. The only logical explanation that I can think of for this is that the WWF had that weird foray into the Houston market where Paul Bosch said, screw you, Jim Crockett Promotions, because as I understand it, Paul Bosch was upset that he was not in the loop of the sale of the UWF to Jim Crockett Promotions. So because of that, he went to Vince, cut the deal, and now Houston Wrestling became a WWF program. And maybe you want to have Sam Houston there? I don't know, but there will be plenty of other guys from the UWF who worked in Houston who were much better than Sam Houston in terms of, you know, popularity and anything else, much bigger names, which I'm sure I will get into in more detail on next week's show. When Bruce Pritchard is doing the introductions, Eddie Gilbert comes up to him, puts his arm around him, and I notice that Eddie is wearing a Pro Wrestling This Week shirt, which is the Joe Pedicino show that would cover, you know, all the various territories, just news and notes from all over the place. And I thought, Eddie Gilbert is certainly a connected guy to sheets and news sources and whatever in professional wrestling, because he always seemed to, you know, he knew how to cultivate those sources, certainly as well as some people who might be cultivating Meltzer or other guys, you know, buddying up to them, knowing that, you know, favorable coverage will lead to maybe more money for them at some point down the road. And it also reminds me that, and I've said this with Eddie Gilbert a couple of times now, him doing a podcast these days, of course, he passed away 25 years ago, but oh my God. Now, I don't know if he would be on that Conrad network, but I would be okay with that because I think he'd do a good enough job with it, but I think eventually Eddie would get tired of it and would want to do it by himself. It's just one of the tragedies of losing Eddie Gilbert at such a young age, because he would be prime for something like that now. One of the reasons why I'm not that fond of Sam Houston is that stupid two-step thing that he would do. Now, I don't know if this is something that cowboys would do on the regular. I'm not from Texas. I'm from Massachusetts. I have no idea of that culture or any sort of thing. But the only two-step that I accept in my life is from the Sega Genesis game, Bulls versus Lakers, where you could press special buttons and get Tim Hardaway of the Golden State Warriors to do the UTEP two-step. Like, with other special moves with other guys, but the UTEP two-step of Tim Hardaway is the only two-step that I will accept into my heart. None of this Sam Houston crap. And I notice for this bout, there is no entourage for Eddie Gilbert, and it's pointed out on commentary as well. And oddly, this match starts out with a crisscross. It makes me wonder if Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior were agenting this thing. Obviously not, as it leads to a roll-up by Sam Houston for two. As Jim Ross, once again, I mean, the dude is nothing but a salesman. Yes, I know he's on that Conrad network now. He sold the syndication packages for the UWF. He may have hustled and told Crockett that they were going to sell to the WWF if they didn't act now. I mean, he is a bit of a hustler. But here he is selling, apparently, there was a UWF magazine?
Also want to remind the fans, if you'd like to subscribe to the official magazine of the UWF, All Pro Wrestling, you can call 24 hours a day at area code 214-888-3232. And this address is very important. Post Office Box UWF, Dallas, Texas, 75379-6488.
I love that he mentions that you can call 24 hours a day as if somebody's going to be up at 3:15 in the morning calling to subscribe to the magazine of a promotion that's literally going to drop dead by the following week. But also, he reads the zip plus 4 zip code, which I thought was interesting because I don't think those were commonplace until much later than 1987. It's just kind of an interesting deal where zip plus 4, like that, I don't remember hearing about those until later into the 90s. Apparently, the Zip Plus 4 got rolled out in 1983, but, you know, I was so young then, I wouldn't really remember. I just don't remember seeing it on stuff until later. And yes, I did call that 214-888-3232 number, and it is disconnected. Doesn't really lead to anywhere. Drop Toe Hold by Eddie, and then you get a trade of Hammerlocks, and then an arm drag by Sam Houston, you know, just kind of your generic babyface offense, as Eddie working a faster pace here than what I'm accustomed to. And I'm kind of used to seeing him, you know, selling as a babyface, doing squirrely stuff as a heel. It's very, very different from what I've generally seen in the past. And you get a knee and a knee lift by Eddie to regain control, but then he misses on a clothesline and then ends up in an arm bar again, as Sam Houston being very, very lazy here. For a guy who's so lightweight, he doesn't do a lot of high-flying stuff, which is kind of my critique of him during this time period. And his legs are so skinny, and his arms. I mean, he makes Adam Cole look like Brock Lesnar, for God's sakes. Eddie Gilbert with an uppercut, but then misses on an elbow, and we got to sit in another arm bar. But then Sam starts working the tricep would be better than the dubstep that he's doing, but he's just kind of hitting knees to the tricep as they go to an ad break, right as Eddie Gilbert locks in an abdominal stretch off an Irish whip. When they come back from that ad break, there's no abdominal stretch. Instead, Sam Houston is being tossed to the outside, where Eddie shows no interest at all in letting him back in the ring, doing the King of the Mountain spot, kind of letting us in on his roots being early 80s WWF, because that was something that was very commonplace, where the heels would just kind of keep the baby face on the outside and just would not let them re-enter the ring. But Sam Houston hits a headbutt to the gut and does the sunset flip in. Gilbert manages to keep his balance and hits him with a right hand, but then misses with a running clothesline, and the two of them end up clotheslining each other, which is really more of a big man spot, but hey, I'll let it go, at least for this match, as Eddie follows up this as when both of them finally get to their feet with a back suplex. Sam Houston had tried to hit him. Usually you see the atomic drop, but that's a babyface move. So Eddie, the back suplex, letting All Japan know that while he might be too small for the WWF, he could come in and dump people on their heads at any point. I mean, he can work as needed. By the way, did you know that Eddie Gilbert's reign as television champion, 148 days, the UWF television title, longest in the title's history, and that would be retired after Starrcade 87 when Nikita Koloff beats Terry Taylor and ends up uniting the titles. After Double Clothesline, both of them are pretty slow to rise. Gilbert puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran, and gets hit with a neck breaker. Which is funny, because you go back to 1983, Mass Superstar put Eddie Gilbert out with the swinging neck breaker of the exact same style. But suplex is blocked by Sam Houston, who ends up getting it, and Eddie then does a flare flop sort of randomly. It's a shame those two guys didn't get along, because I think they probably, kind of like Virgil and Repo Man, Eddie Gilbert and Ric Flair had probably more in common than what any differences they might have. Cross-corner whip and a backdrop by Sam Houston. And now Eddie, sensing that he's in trouble, just slugs the referee right before receiving a bulldog by Sam Houston, which was his finisher. But because he hit the referee, that accounts for the DQ. And what a bullcrap finish that was. As Mantell, Ken Mantell on commentary is like, he's won it. Like, all right, stop trying to hide the fact that you booked a bullshit DQ finish when, like, why are we protecting Sam Houston here? Yeah, maybe you don't know he's leaving at this point, but for God's sakes, you know you're keeping the title on Eddie Gilbert for, well, actually, I guess not, because it's going over to JCP Control. Who cares? It's Thunderdome in here. It's a complete madhouse. I mean, total par for the course of the store's closing. Who gives a shit what happens with the merchandise, right?
The Universal Wrestling Federation Training Center is open. Never in the history of professional wrestling has the general public been offered the opportunity to actually become a superstar. If you've ever even dreamed dreamed of being a wrestler, manager, or valet, the UWF Training Center is where your road to superstardom begins. You'll learn the ins and outs from the pros themselves. You'll train with the champions as you prepare for the glamour, the excitement, the prestige, and the million-dollar contracts that are the world of professional wrestling. The response to our star search has been overwhelming, and the immediate success of the students in our very first session clearly shows that the stars of the future will all come from the UWF Training Center. The chance of a lifetime is yours for the asking. We'll give you the key that unlocks the door to a career in pro wrestling.
I looked up to see if I could find anything about the UWF Training Center. It's the same thing as the UWF magazine, or the same problem that I ran into, which was I type in UWF as a search term, and yeah, you think, oh, well, were you running into an issue with multiple promotions called the UWF? You got Herb Abrams, you got the one in Japan, even though it was like UWFI, but no, that had nothing to do with it. I was getting University of West Florida as results in there, and I was getting really annoyed. It's like UWF training, and they thought it was some sort of training thing at the college. So I guess, you know, finding stuff like this from the 80s is a little bit more difficult than anticipated. I mean, who really cares about all of that? Just, as I always say, imagine that you're the person watching this in 1987, and you're watching the UWF, and you don't really know what's going on. You're not privy to all the backstage stuff that's happening. I mean, that was fairly common in 1987. And you've decided, you know what? I'm going to make the leap. I want to become a pro wrestler, and you call that number, and you want to go to the UWF training school, and you do it on this particular week when it is the last time that the UWF, as you know it, is going to exist. Like, imagine that guy signing up, like, at this point. There might be one person out there who was like that. It's just so insane.
And they're back. Why do these hands disappear? Because they're not really hands at all. They're actually electronic pulses of light. Introducing the amazing laser beam wristwatch. Destined to become a legend in its own time, we believe it will soon be one of the most sought-after watches in history. However, as part of a special publicity campaign, we will send you one of these amazing new laser beam luxury watches. Not for the hundreds of dollars you might expect, but for only $10. But to get your amazing laser beam wristwatch for only $10, you must act now. If you call within the next 30 minutes, you can order a second laser beam watch for only $5, just half price.
Apparently, there are health benefits to wearing a laser watch that I was not aware of until reading about it just a few minutes ago. I just thought it was kind of an odd commercial to have on there, but then again, there were a lot of interesting health fads in the 80s, but it seems like that those things still exist today, so maybe I'm mistaken in calling it a fad. As we go to a promo now, it's Bruce Pritchard again with General Skandor Akbar, who was a manager in Mid-South for a lot of years, and of course in World Class as well. He was there before, he would be there after this. But Skandor Akbar, I don't know how he rose to become, you know, to the rank of general, but he had to have been an admiral at some point. Maybe it's just the Star Wars in me, but I just wish that somebody had suggested that something was a trap to him, or got him to say it's a trap.
I exposed you for what you are, Michael. You're a fraud. You talk about this, and you talk about what a great negotiator, what a great leader that you are, and you filthy brothers, but I told them, and I did it into you, Michael. I told everybody. What was going to happen, Michael? You're on the outside looking in. You talk about bad street. There's no bad street. It's closed due to repairs because I went down to your house, Michael. You, Buddy, and Terry, and I kicked the doors in. I took the one-man gang and Wild Bill Irwin and now Angel Muhammad, my latest and greatest acquisition. I made a man out of him. He's no longer American. This country offered him nothing, but I took him and I made him a true man.
All right, that goes on for about 2 full minutes, maybe a little bit longer of a managerial promo than what you might need. All this talk of I made him into a man, referring to Angel Muhammad, which it could mean one of two things. Either number one, he gave him a bar mitzvah, which considering that his last name is Muhammad now, I find that to be highly unlikely. Or he could have made him a man, perhaps by f***ing him in the ass. Probably unlikely that that took place, but I'm not willing to rule anything out. These are the last days of Rome here, so anything goes, quite frankly, whether it be in Akbar's camp or anywhere else. But believe it or not, we have a TV time remaining match. Yes, I know I said Eddie Gilbert versus Sam Houston was the future bout. We got a minute 40 left in the video as I took this note as they start to do the ring introductions, and it is Angel Muhammad taking on, and I just put ... because now we're down to a minute left in this video, and I don't even know who the opponent is. Whether is this going to be like a Goldberg squash from 98, one of that style? But the opponent is, in fact, Chris Adams, who's accompanied by Terry Taylor, so he showed up on time for this one. And they are mobbed by the fans getting to the ring, and I just want to slap them and be like, hey, do you realize, you know, we're trying to get this match in before the, you know, it's a TV time remaining match, people, and there's literally no time by the time they get into the ring. Like, what the hell is going on here? We don't hear a bell or anything. It's truly a Watsian way to end his tenure at the UWF, because while he did like to present everything as sport, and I like that as well, perhaps maybe we could have trimmed back that Akbar promo, or maybe not aired it at all, and maybe put 2 minutes of this match in there. At least get to the freaking match. Instead, we get a TV time remaining match that never actually happens because you don't even get to the freaking introductions. So, what a weird way to go out. I mean, did we really need General Akbar for 2 consecutive minutes? But, oh well. This is the end of the UWF as we know it. I don't know if you feel fine, but this is a very weird show. And I'm looking forward to next week's weird show for the May 5th or the May 2nd edition. I get crossed up because the person who put it on YouTube put on 02/05/87. They did like the European thing. And that's very confusing because it looks like it says February 5th, which is why I didn't cover this sooner. So that's it. For the UWF, Bill Watts era, for April 25th, 1987. I am pleased to inform you that Steve Bennett of the Sportscasters and I have recorded half of an Adams Division podcast, putting together a WrestleMania card with a specific set of rules that I came up with. Can't reuse a title match, can't reuse a wrestler, and you can't use the same match, you can't use matches at the same WrestleMania more than once. So you can't choose Hogan Andre and Savage Steamboat. We have half of that done. Unfortunately, when we went to do our second one, Steve lost power in a snowstorm up in Buffalo, but we're going to get that recorded by this time next week. I think it should be out, but we still got to work out details on that. Now, in other podcasts, our Vantage Point podcast, continuing their series, the Royal Rankings on Managers, that's been particularly enjoyable to listen to, especially the love that they have for Sensational Sherry. That was on there a couple of weeks ago, but do check that out, our Vantage Point. And the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, they bid farewell last week, which I can't, it was expected but also unexpected because I called in to congratulate them and suggested that, you know, bits for the next 200 shows, but apparently that will not come to be. They did release something that was basically a replay of the first 15 minutes saying goodbye from their podcast. But I can tell you the lesson that we've learned from the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett, Brian Malonis, and Brian Fury is, in the 4 years that they did that show, Brian Malonis went from occasionally working chaotic shows in sort of semi-retirement almost, to now being a contracted Ring of Honor wrestler, also working on NWA Power as well. Brian Fury, owner now of Chaotic Wrestling, a mover and shaker, spent some time down in the Performance Center for WWE in the last month or two and missed a lot of the podcasts to do that. And then there's Mike Crockett, which I will say for Mike that nothing gets your career jump-started quite like working with Mike Crockett. Sure, sure, he might kind of be in the same place, although, you know, he's certainly progressed over the last 4 years, now has a family and all, I can't help but think of him as like the episode of Seinfeld, fitting because, you know, the very heavy Seinfeld theme. It's the wrestling podcast about nothing, after all, where Jerry was signing the checks for 12 cents. And he kept getting, that guy kept saying to him, "Don't worry, things will pick up soon."
Ah, hi, Brett. Have you ever heard of an umbrella? I didn't have enough money. Sure things will pick up for you.
Well, that podcast will be missed, but they do have 200 episodes in an archive that's going to be out there for the next couple months. So go download Crazy at this point with those and grab them while you can. One thing that I definitely missed that I can bring back for this week because the video is from YouTube is YouTube Comment Theater. And as always, these are actual YouTube comments left by actual users. On the new interface on YouTube where the comments are closer to where the video window is, at least on the app, I still have not gotten used to it. And they have a thing where if you scroll to the bottom, it then redirects you. Oh, the comments are up here. So some interesting ones here on this video that has been on YouTube for over a year. As DM79542 says, "Love the Seinfeld theme song at the beginning." Apparently a little unaware, as John DuPont, I don't think it's the real John DuPont, says, "That's actually Play the Bass by Stanley Clark." And sure enough, if you look that up on YouTube, you can hear the entire thing. DM9542 also says, "Bruce Pritchard without the red makeup. Go figure." That was only 4 months ago. Apparently doesn't know that the guy had a career before WWF, WWE, and maybe doesn't know him from the podcast. John DuPont has a comment of his own. "The final UWF taping before Bill Watts sold the promotion to Jim Crockett." Well, no shit. I already said that earlier in the show. Doc the Metal Freak says, "Brother Love doing the ring announcing. Imagine that." Yeah, he had done a lot of work in the Houston territory. This UWF thing, I don't think he was there all that long, because I think he was working for Bosch much of the time. But, you know, it is what it is. Bruce Pritchard always finds a way to get himself a job. I mean, he goes into this podcast talking about how WWE will never rehire him. And what happens? Sure enough, he gets rehired. Vlad Moya says, "OMG, Chris Adams talking about alcohol. This is in relation to his arrest for being drunk on a flight and starting a riot on there. Eventually, alcohol would lead to Adams' death, as many years later, he was shot to death by an acquaintance after another drunken brawl." And yeah, he got himself into trouble numerous times, but eventually leads to his death. And is ruled a self-defense shooting. Kind of obvious and clear-cut based on the story. Marco Sweet says, "Baby doll, looking good." I don't know about that. I mean, Nicola is standing next to Missy Hyatt and Sunshine. Now, Sunshine looked the worst for wear at this point in time. But 1987 Missy Hyatt, although I do wish, you know, she was kind of hiding the boobs behind sweaters. And I don't particularly care for that. Roger King says, "Stan Lee presents MWF, Marvel Wrestling Federation," to which William Farr replies, "Shut up, you idiot." I don't understand what the bit is there. I really, if anybody can provide insight on that, I would greatly appreciate it, because I don't know what the hell he's talking about. And finally, Daniel Parra says, "My goodness, Dark Journey is gorgeous. I wonder if she was black or Hispanic. She's better looking than Missy Hyatt and Sunshine. She had more balls and spark than Sunshine and Missy put together." I'll agree that Dark Journey was pretty hot, or as Ty Webb put it in Caddyshack, "Oh, you're rather attractive for a beautiful girl with a great body." And yes, she, I believe, was mixed race, but I can't remember the exact thing with all of that, and I really don't want to go down that road. So that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Ferdy made plenty clear that next week's show will be UWF TV from the following week, May 2nd, 1987, as Jim Crockett Promotions assumes control of everything, and the entire thing stops on a dime, starting with the intro of the host of the program. But you'll have to tune in next week to learn more about that. But why you wait until then? You know, why don't you leave a review on iTunes, Apple Music, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine reviews are accepted for podcasts? Twitter? I don't know about Twitter, because that's, I don't know if fine anything can be found on Twitter, or Facebook for that matter. But if you do leave a review someplace, it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this particular podcast. And I thank you so much for listening. I have to admit, I really enjoy doing this show on a weekly basis, especially this week, because it gave me a chance to vent about the whole stupid SummerSlam ticket thing at the top of the show. All right, that's enough out of me, but tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
But I took him and I made him a true man.